Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A little later, we'll be taking a close-up look at one aspect of who we are as a community as part of St. Louis Public Radio's We Live Here project. But first, we're spending some time talking about where we are in the wake of the Justice Department's report on those racially abusive practices of the Ferguson Police Department. The DOJ was not the only entity looking at Ferguson following the August Michael Brown shooting and its aftermath. Governor Nixon appointed a special commission to study the Ferguson situation. That probe is ongoing, and joining me now is Reverend Starsky Wilson, co-chair of the commission. Reverend Wilson, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I know you've just passed the 100-day mark of your work with the commission. Coincidental, the DOJ report came out at the same time. Mm-hmm. Are you finding everything that the Justice Department said has come up during the commission's work so far? Or did you find anything contrary to what you've discovered?
There are many themes from the Justice Department report, and quite frankly, some of the recommendations of the 21st Century Policing Report from the President's Task Force that came out last Monday that we have heard about. So testimony to people who feel like they've been targeted because they're from vulnerable populations. We've heard that testimony in our public meetings. We've had seven of them so far. And quite frankly, some of the recommendations that we hear about looking more intentionally at our use of force statutes and approaches and training, being thoughtful about an orientation of policing culture that may be driven by municipal courts. And the layer that is missing, quite frankly, that we hear from the national reports is why these revenue targets are there. And for us, we recognize in our region that the municipal fragmentation may very well be one of the driving forces behind that kind of targeted policing and the use of municipal courts as ATMs for these kinds of systems.
Will, do you think the commission recommendations go beyond, or could they go beyond, Ferguson? Because as you mentioned, this is really kind of a regional situation.
Yeah, actually, the commission's orientation has always been regional. The governor, when he appointed the commission in Executive Order 1415, invited us to be thoughtful about policy recommendations that would lead to a stronger, fairer, and more inclusive St. Louis region. So to use the language of one of our media outlets here, the DOJ report focused on Ferguson A, the municipality. The commission's work really focuses on Ferguson B, the issues that have been exposed, the underlying conditions that we find with the specific interest in the St. Louis region.
Clearly, Ferguson is not unique.
No, Ferguson is not unique when we talk about the municipality. We've heard everyone from the DOJ report, which actually makes a reference to neighboring municipalities. We've seen more action recently from the FBI in looking at Bell Fountain neighbors and some practices and emails that are found there that connect municipal courts to policing practices. And even Mayor Knowles has noted in his response to the report that, they are likely not the most egregious when we start talking about revenue or when we talk about racialized policing in our community. So it is helpful for us all to take this report as an input for us to be reflective upon and look at all of our practices in light of what we see in this report.
You know, a lot of people, it seems to me, were surprised by the social justice issues that were raised after the Michael Brown shooting. But these are issues that are not new by any stretch of the imagination.
No, unfortunately, these are not new issues. These are things that if we connect them, we can draw a line all the way back to the 50th anniversary of Selma. We can draw a line back beyond that to racialized practices de facto and de jure in our country. And so I think we've got to be intentional about making sure that in as much as we know these things are not new, that they are present. Part of our reality, they're also part of our history. This also means that we must be intentional in every generation to give consideration to how these things impact our culture.
What happens to whatever series of recommendations you come up with? What's the process?
Yeah, so our hope, so we've been engaged over the last 100 days. We've had now 12 public meetings, engaged over 1,200 citizens in those meetings, heard over 11 special interest kind of reports from experts, posted 22 different reports on our website at stlpositivechange.org. And the reason I point all that out is because we believe that robust community engagement in our process, hearing the voices of people in our process, will help to inform translation, implementation, and sustainability of any of our recommendations. So our commitment is that as we make recommendations, that they not just be about policies, but that we will also identify parties who have the authority to act. And we will map a course forward so that the community itself will receive this report in as much as Governor Nixon does. And so folks will have the opportunity to say, if I want to work on building community policing in our area, which this is one of the things we've been talking about a lot, or if I want to work on reducing or strengthening the use of force statute at the state level, then I know who's accountable and I know how to map out a process to get there. So my community group can take this report, look at it, and see who we need to be asking questions of, who we need to hold accountable. Some of that's going to be on the state level. Some of that's going to be on a very local level. So it's our hope that that kind of engagement will produce that kind of process in the community. But we're also beginning to think very intentionally about what we leave in place to monitor a scorecard versus these recommendations and some ongoing monitoring.
You're going to shake some trees.
Well, I think we've got to, quite frankly, for the sake of the children that we serve who will be most impacted by these recommendations. And whatever we build now, there are young people who will be who will live in this and have to live with this. So I think if we keep them in mind and put them at the center of the conversation, we'll come up with better recommendations.
We talked about this for a moment before we went on the air, and I've talked about it before on this program, that being that we have been down this road before somewhat. There have been incidents in the past. You go back to Selma and beyond, certainly. And there's always a lot of conversation, and then things kind of just dissipate until something happens again. Is this different this time?
I think it must be different. I think if we look back in our history, one of the books that I've read and continue to live with in this moment is called Flak Catchers, by an author by the name of Lindsay Lupo, who traces 100 years of what she calls riot commission politics in America, going back to Harlem riots in 1916 and 17. Around that same time, we had the East St. Louis race riots here in the St. Louis region. My challenge is that if we are as creative as we were in that time, the population trends that we saw then, the difficulty and strife and unrest, and the social factors that were exposed led to the establishment of the Urban League of Metropolitan St. Louis. And for now, almost 100 years, that has been providing effective service to our community. The question is, will we be so creative? Will we be so engaged with our policy and engagement this time such that we will leave something that will have a lasting legacy to serve generations beyond? I think we will, because I really take hope and heart in the kind of engagement and activism I see in young people, the preparation and capacity building I see happening in advocacy organizations in our region around this work. And quite frankly, the fact that many of our policymakers, both civic, corporate, and otherwise, recognize that this can't be the image of our city. And perhaps our only hope going forward is to write a narrative of how you rebuild after these tragedies.
The young people hold the key.
I think they hold significant keys if they have the kind of commitment to working this process through that we have seen, then I think they do. But I also believe that we've not exactly given up all the keys to the Chevy yet. And so there are folks who are elected to positions that are leading major firms and organizations in our community, philanthropies in our community, that need to directly engage in this work and conversation and begin to make policy changes there for the sake of allowing space for the young people to continue to work.
You and the other commission members are being and have been exposed to a lot of emotion during the meetings that you've held. How is that playing with you personally and also with the other commission members? I know you can't speak for everyone, but generally, how is it playing?
Yeah, I think, I mean, they're very difficult times. I've shared with folks close to me that this Lenten season that we Christians celebrate in honor of reflection and renunciation was timely for me this year because in as much as there are some expressions that really affect and shake others, I don't get that excited down about a group of angry folks from vulnerable neighborhoods, because I've been one. And so that doesn't bother me as much. But the difficulty of navigating the various circles and emotions around this, there are people just as upset about the unrest as there are people upset about the policies. There are people who feel as earnestly that change should not be made, that everything's working well, as there are people who believe there should be change. And so as commissioners, we've had to embrace all of those different groups and feel all of their emotions and seek to find some truth of our own in the midst of that. I think that is the more difficult emotional kind of yearning and churning that I've been wrestling with.
That's all going to have to be worked into whatever recommendations that you come up with, obviously.
Yes, sir. And at this point, we really begin this work. The next phase of our work will be more earnest about these conversations of racial reconciliation, equity, and inclusion. And this is where the rubber hits the road. It cuts across all of these areas of work groups that we've set up around citizen law enforcement engagement or municipal courts and governance or educational and economic inequity. The reality is we know that race is a part of our culture. It is, as one theologian suggested, America's original sin. And so we all must manage and deal with this and then think about how this plays into all of these recommendations.
You're listening to the Reverend Starsky Wilskin. He is a co-chair of the Ferguson Commission, which is looking into the situation in Ferguson and other areas in North County following the death of Michael Brown on August 9th. By the way, Reverend Wilson is also the pastor at the St. John's Church in St. Louis, and he's been busy in that job as well. Reverend Wilson, we'll come back in just a moment. We'll have a few minutes for phone calls. If you'd like to get into the conversation, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@sdopublicradio.org, or we'll take a tweet at SDL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Now back to Reverend Starsky Wilson. He's the pastor of St. John's United Church of Christ in St. Louis and, as we've mentioned, co-chair of the Ferguson Commission. Reverend Wilson, I'm curious as to what your reaction might have been to listening and watching events over the weekend in Selma, in which the President of the United States was referencing Ferguson, as he has done before and many have done since the Brown shooting.
Yeah. So I must say, this weekend was packed with significant emotion for me. I had the challenge on Monday. I had the challenge on Saturday of both speaking to a delegation of church members in the Illinois South Conference of the United Church of Christ, based on our work at the Ignatz Foundation, and about the state of children in the region. And then later went to celebrate the fifth birthday of one of my sons. In between, I ended up catching tweets before I got the chance to see the entire speech from the president. But I thought it was significant to see the kind of, number one, the degree of folks, the delegation of folks who are here, who are there from St. Louis, the mm-hmm. entire kind of Ferguson to Selma delegation. There were also delegations of philanthropic executives who worked together on the Selma for Students initiative, which we were participating with, and folks who sought to raise these issues. I think that the critical question, mm-hmm. seminal for me, beyond the grace and oratory and the liturgical design of the handoff between John Lewis and the president, all these things that were powerful and palpable, the imagery of the bridge that the president used and the suggestion that we have miles to go tells us that we are on this ongoing journey. I think that's powerful. We remember this as we take a comma, kind of put a comma here at our 100-day report for the Ferguson Commission, but also say that on September 15th, when we hand off the report to the community, and to the governor, there is still a great amount of work to do. What we have, quite frankly, in this moment is the historical example that what happened on that bridge when the attention of the country was arrested by a group of American citizens being tear gassed mm-hmm. by police. And to be clear, this is exactly what has happened here. I do not believe necessarily that we would be speaking in the same way unless America saw those images in mid-August. And having that same thing, that was translated into a kind of movement towards specific and distinct policy change in the Voting Rights Act that we must be thoughtful about as well here. That is the most significant mark we can get to, is when we know there has been significant, concrete, transformative policy change out of this moment.
Yeah, that the timing of that anniversary is significant for us here. There's no question about it.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that struck me as I was watching that was the fact that the president's daughters were there, and they're likely to be there for the 100th anniversary.
Yes, yes.
And they'll be in their 70s, I guess.
Yeah, and this is a significant part of American history. Yeah. And there are ways in which, again, if we are caring, careful, intentional, committed, that what happens after this moment of August 9th should be a part of our American narrative as it touches. It has already woven together narratives from as far flung as Staten Island and Oakland and Cleveland and Beaver Creek. And as much as it has cast that broad net here across the nation in this moment in time, the reality is this is something that connects historically and should connect in the future if we are faithful to the moment and get to the kind of transformative change this requires.
Reverend Starsky Wilson, let's take a call. We've got Panchia calling from St. Louis County. I hope I have the name pronounced correctly. Go ahead, please.
Hello. I would like the Reverend to respond to this question. I keep hearing local leaders and citizens talking about reconciliation and healing. As I reflect on South Africa, there had to be significant intentional activities before reconciliation and healing take place. What does the Reverend think those activities and actions, those intentional, significant, concrete actions need to be before we ask citizens to move to a place of reconciliation and healing?
Well, thank you very much, Panchia. I've said to people in the past when I was asked early on the question, when do you think the protests will stop? I said the protests will stop when the reforms begin. And I think that is we've got to see clear action on policy change moving for folks to have the trust in the systems to begin to reengage. I think that the work of reconciliation, again, this is theological terminology. And so I think we must be careful to note that this is not something that we rush to. That reconciliation, if you use the South African example, requires a space for appropriate truth-telling. There are truth-telling tables. There's a group meeting here in mid-March, Greater St. Mark, for a couple of days to really kind of engage in that process and learning. Unfortunately, this is actually one of the problems I have, if I'm able to have one with Desmond Tutu, is that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and Councils actually afforded for a process of forgiveness and absolution that at some levels are necessary if you want to get to people really being able to share their truth, particularly about atrocities that they have engaged. And so I think we have to be very intentional about what that work is. Yes, truth telling is something that must be required. There must be some acceptance of responsibility before there can be reconciliation. And there must be forgiveness. I mean, these are the things that are really required to get to true reconciliation. I also believe that we should think about the term reconciliation in financial terms. I say that because at my church, we won't let the financial secretary and the treasurer leave the room until the financial secretary's count from the offering matches that which the treasurer is to deposit in the bank. So we've got to get to those things being equitable before we can move on. So I think we must be considerate of a racial equity lens in our policymaking. Think about how specific policies like the things we see in the DOJ report about the Ferguson Police Department impact different communities. And when you can say that this is the fifth most racially segregated metropolitan area in the nation and say that you have racialized policing happening in Ferguson, then it tells you need to take a different lens to your policy. So I think those things are helpful.
We must keep in mind that reconciliation doesn't take place overnight either. It takes time.
Absolutely.
We have another caller here. It's Pianchi calling from Ferguson. Go ahead, Pianchi.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was going to tell Mr. Starkey is that the employment and the racial makeup of the police department, city hall, fire department, public works, and even the school district reminds me of the same argument that was going on just recently with the Mississippi River Bridge project between St. Louis and Illinois, and the fact that you have this imbalance that has to be taken care of. Why not put a training program in position that would prerequisite and pre-train your residents there in that area for those jobs and have attrition hiring program similar to the one that was put in place through the 1985 court decision for the city of St. Louis and their fire department and police?
Okay, thanks. Let's get a response.
Yeah, I think you appropriately note that people must be equipped for and find jobs with wages capable for supporting their households. This is something we've seen in this kind of conversation about economic mobility, the kinds of training programs you suggest and the equity assessments. That's a policy assessment to say we've got to have a certain makeup on jobs that come from the state and the like are things that tend to economic mobility. One of the staggering statistics we found from Dr. Raj Chetty of Harvard University is that St. Louis region ranks 42nd in the top 50 metropolitan areas when it comes to economic mobility, the capacity for someone to move from poverty to working class to middle class to upper middle class, we've got to do something about that track. So when we have economic conversations in this region, it's helpful to have a conversation about economic development and big box development. But we also need to be thoughtful about what it takes for a person to make their lives better. That's the American dream conversation. It's about economic mobility, not broad scale economic development.
It's the key to everything. We only have 1 minute left. And I know that Governor Nixon had indicated, and you've alluded to it, to having recommendations by September. However, he's also said he wouldn't mind if he had them sooner. Is that likely?
That is very likely. So our commitment is to act on recommendations that come from the public as they are fully engaged and vetted through our work groups. Those work groups are also kind of a democratic process. And so we've early got a consensus around municipal courts. So we spoke out early for that. We're pleased that the attorney general stood with us and acted to enforce the Max Creek law. And we plan on other actions as they are ready and have been through the this community engagement process, standing out, making calls when they're clear and inviting people to act.
And you have another reason for wanting September to be free on your calendar, because you're expecting the birth of a daughter.
Absolutely. My first baby girl coming in September. So respect to the governor. I'm really looking forward to that more than this September 15th report date.
Starsky Wilson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back in just a moment.